Welcome to another edition of El Paso Primetime. Having a good time this afternoon talking about some vintage horror films with Jay Duncan. First off, Jay, welcome to El Paso Primetime.
Thank you, Dennis. Pleasure to be here.
I'm telling you what, you've got such a choice collection of of flicks that have been going on all the month of October, heading into next week's Halloween. I mean, today you've got Misery.
Yes.
Yay.
Yeah. Hey. Okay. Hey, we can't ignore Mr. King. You know, we have to at least have a sampling of Stephen King's work in here. You know,
very true. Let's go ahead and talk about the venue, the International Museum of Art. First off, and your collaborative efforts to keep the name of the International Museum of Art in the community's eye.
Right. Right. Well, as a little sprout, and we all were once, that was the El Paso Museum of Art. That was the place to be for galleries, for even back in the 60s, you know, this was pre-video days. So they actually showed, and I saw for the first time, like Andalusian Dog, you know, the Buñuel, Salvador Dali short, Tales of Hoffman, The Red Shoes on 16mm film. In the basement auditorium, before there were auditorium seats. It was folding chairs and so forth. So it was rudimentary, but it was an opportunity to see films that certainly at that time you wouldn't see on television.
Right.
And so I have a fond place in my heart for the old Turney home and Trost architecture, growing up and seeing the exhibits and seeing the films during the years, you know.
It's a beautiful place to be. I remember going to just checking out the Kress collection when it was there.
Absolutely.
And it was a sight to behold, especially in wintertime. Wintertime, they had a propensity for decorating in Victorian Christmas.
Yes, yes.
Man, you want to talk some fond memories. So heading over to the International Museum of Art for your collection of films really does make for a real interesting venue.
It does. It does. You know, you feel the elegance of 1910, 11, when that home was originally built, hardwood floors and marble galore. And, you know, it's kind of comforting, yet not sterile. It's welcoming at the same time. And, of course, you know, the new director, as of March, is a go-getter. And she wants to remind people there's always something going on. And every Sunday, from 2 to 4, there's a social Sunday.
Mm-hmm.
It's come in, have some refreshments, see the galleries, mix and greet. And so, you know, that's one thing. The films are another thing. You know, we just had, as of the 17th, no, the 10th, tribute to Bill Racassi that passed away earlier this year, with about between 30 and 40 of his original works. Leon Blevins did a Perspectives interview with him in, I think, 2008, and so that was shown in the auditorium. So it was an opportunity to pay tribute to an El Paso artist who's known beyond our borders here, and also he was quite a friend of the El Paso Museum of Art, later the International Museum of Art. So there's always something happening there.
It's a wonderful thing to keep happening and keep people going to the International Museum of Art. And with the Sunset Film Society's choice films this time around, how could you miss?
I know. You know, once October was looming up, I thought, yeah, we got to do it. We got to do it. And you know, like I stress and like I mentioned on the flyer and it's on the website, if you're looking for gore and slice and dice films, this is not your cup of hemlock. You know, this is however, if you appreciate the atmosphere and the storytelling, well-crafted, fantastic films and classic television shows, we welcome you. And so it's family-friendly. There's no gore. Very little in the case of Misery. It's implied more than shown.
Right.
But it's pretty much family friendly. And so it's an opportunity to see lots of black and white and some color too, you know.
Yeah, the serial, the two that you're showing, the Superman Chapter 3.
Oh, yeah.
And the Twilight Zone, the Eyes of the Beholder. That's one of my favorite episodes.
Absolutely.
By the way.
And do you notice a common thread between that episode and Misery?
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Both have to do with bedridden people.
in a warped sort of way, yeah, I see it.
That's right. If you close one eye and squint real hard, you can kind of imagine that.
Right.
But no, I'm trying to cull, classic television in addition to classic film. And, of course, The Twilight Zone was a five-year running phenomenon. Mr. Sterling wrote, I think, 85% of the scripts.
Right.
Hundreds and hundreds of episodes. And earlier, when we first kicked off on October 3rd, we showed one of the better, and of course, they're all, I think, pretty first-rate classic episodes of The Outer Limits.
Mm-hmm.
And this, when you look back at who either was just coming, coming on board as an actor, it's a who's who of people that later went on to become, people that everybody knows, from Cliff Robertson to Robert Duvall to Robert Culp and on Sally Kellerman and on and on and on.
Mm-hmm.
They all kind of, everybody has to start somewhere, and the quite a number of really top-notch actors, writers, cinematographers, Conrad Hall, shot that episode of The Outer Limits, and he went on to win an Oscar for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and American Beauty. And, he shown himself to be quite adept at not only black and white and mood cinema, but also color as well.
Well, even the soundtrack, Dominic Frontier, had written quite I'd like to call it the iconic.
Yes.
Theme song.
Absolutely.
And the Twilight Zone theme,
yeah.
Those are two of the most recognizable things you'll ever run into your life, other than the usual MASH and all that stuff.
Oh, sure, sure, yeah. In those days, too, like we know, they actually hired studio musicians. And it wasn't necessarily just a keyboard artist on a synthesizer that creates the theme for a television show. But they brought in the case, 20, 25 musicians. So you have the whole gamut. And people, again, Henry Mancini, as we know, too, started out without any credit.
Right.
He was involved in scoring part of Creature from the Black Lagoon for Universal. But Joseph Gershenson, as head of the music department, always put his name on the credits.
Mm-hmm.
So you never knew really who composed, a lot of the theme songs and a lot of the tracks in the films in the 50s.
Well, the whole thing, the notoriety about Henry Mancini goes back to Blake Edwards, really. If it hadn't been for Blake and Henry running into each other at that barbershop,
that's true.
The theme from Peter Gunn would never be out there.
I know. And talk about a classic, iconic score.
Mm-hmm.
I know you hear the theme from that. You hear Mr. Lucky. You hear pretty much anything Henry Mancini did. It's all not only unmistakably his, but it's just good music.
Yeah.
And you don't hear a lot of really good theme songs anymore on television shows.
No, and if it's good, it's not everlasting.
No.
That's the problem.
That's right.
I was thinking about it the other day driving home, and there was a car that was blasting a sampled version of David Rose's The Stripper.
Okay. Yeah. Dun-ta-dun. Dun-ta-dun.
Seriously, yeah. If you have to sample
what
was already done,
then
you know where the icon really hits.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Well, Jay, let's delve in even deeper into the process of curating every month for the Sunset Film Society. I know that you have to think about the theme.
Sure.
Heading into the holidays, you're going to have your usual thing.
Yeah.
But what happens for the rest of the months when you're out of theme, so to speak?
Right, when there's not a Valentine's Day or a Thanksgiving or Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
We try to mix. I've been at this until I get it right. I've been at this since 1974, when I was doing continuing education classes. And, of course, at that time, again, pre-video, are just barely coming on board. Mm-hmm. People were kind of subject to what I had in my collection on film. And so it might be, the classic television. It could be a classic animation. It could be science fiction or horror, a certain director. But now that video is out there and pretty much everything is available generally,
mm-hmm,
in one form or another, whether it's Laserdisc that may not have made the transition yet to DVD or Blu-ray, there's an awful lot to pick from. And so the whole point of the Sunset Film Society is to offer a sampling of good, you know, in all categories.
Right.
Something representative of certain directors. It could be, you know, like years ago when I was doing a weekly series at the El Paso Museum of Art downtown, we had a 10-week series on Alfred Hitchcock, which is not very difficult to do, you know. I mean, he had so many notable films, it was easy to kind of cull from his early days in Britain a classic episode of the Alfred Hitchcock Presents that he directed, because he only directed a handful. Everybody, you know, he introduced them all, but right. He only personally directed a handful, so showed one of those. And then the usual, you know, whether it's Vertigo or North by Northwest or Psycho or even The Trouble with Harry, just to show kind of a black humor streak. What we try to do is, and there's never really been a theme other than, you know, we started doing this in August of 2013 at a historic home in Sunset Heights.
Right.
And so, you know, how I picked the initial film on that was, I thought it was not obvious, but when you see this is a 1908 vintage home, you know, all the original furnishings pretty much are there. You know, the beveled glass, the hardwood floors, and so forth. And I thought, what would be good to introduce the film society in some kind of a setting similar to this? Because you're sitting in there and you're just absorbing the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, why not somewhere in time, you know, which is set in 1912, it takes place in current 1980 Chicago, and then most of the film is taking place in 1912.
Right.
And I think everybody commented on it seemed to work well like that, because you're seeing things in the Grand Hotel on Mackinac Island and so forth, that you kind of look around in this home and you see similar things, you know, whether it's furniture or the decor of the glass, the leaded glass and things like that. So I try to pick something that's not always something that everybody's seen over and over and over again. Though you know that you could show a Bullet or a French Connection and people still come, which is good, but you want to try to offer things that maybe they're not so familiar with. In the case of October, where we have kind of the thrills and chills and the spooky and the supernatural and a little bit of everything that kind of goes bump, want to show things that maybe younger people may not have seen, but they may have walked past on a Hollywood or a Blockbuster when there was such a thing.
Mm-hmm.
But maybe said, yeah, well, I've heard of Creature from the Black Lagoon. Yeah, I'll have to get that sometime. And, you know, once they sample truly magnificent black and white photography, you know, which is kind of becoming a lost art in cinematography. You know, you don't see black and white movies anymore.
Right.
Only Spielberg can do it,
yeah.
You know, because the powers that be now kind of think that, well, that's passé. But unfortunately, I'm afraid that it's going to kind of go by way of the dodo bird, you know, if we don't, you know, kind of learn from, appreciate, and have retrospects of classic films like that.
Which brings me to one of the more fascinating things that you've got coming up tomorrow, actually. Sunday, October 25th, the Halloween Happening.
How about that?
7 hours of sheer bliss and terror. Yeah, it sounds like a marriage I almost got myself into, but we'll just go someplace else with that.
My lips are sealed. I'm not even going to comment. No, but this is out at Artovino's Desert Crossing, and you know, the Artovino's people and the wait staff and the chef and everybody are just gung-ho on everything they do.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, when you're working with people that are always looking to have new ideas, to try something different, and not those that say, oh, it's never been done, so we don't want to try it, that's a lot of fun. It's a challenge. And so we're starting at noon. And, you know, you can choose to have brunch or a drink. And, you know, hanging around until, you know, the last movie starts at 5, you can have dinner,
mm-hmm,
or another drink or not, because it's not mandatory and it is free. And it's an opportunity just to completely glut yourself with these with four films and a classic Twilight Zone episode.
I like the lineup. And again, this goes back to curating, because there are people who willy-nilly just throw things in there and hope to God the mixmaster does it right. But in your case, it's all in a lineage. It's a chronological order.
You noticed that, yeah. And that you know, when you see things like in order that way, you can kind of subliminally, at least, see kind of the development of the technologies,
mm-hmm.
The story, the development of film in a capsule. You know, and of course, trying to show a variety there, where it's not all one or the other. It's not all horror. It's not all sci-fi. It's, you know, it's a little mix, but it all generally falls into the imaginative cinema, you know, which would anybody that can suspend disbelief, mm-hmm. you know, they should have a good time just riding this lightning bolt.
I think everybody who has any kind of a creative mind has always wanted to be invisible, and certainly Claude Rains played that role quite well.
And that's not a bad debut, is it? I mean, that was his film debut, and I tell people that he's not seen until the final moments of the film, but it's a towering radio performance,
mm-hmm.
and you know, I mean, he just does marvels with that voice of his, you know.
And it's amazing to think that H.G. Wells, you know, just created this character simply because all the rest of us back in the day wanted to do that, but we just didn't have the cojones to sit down and write it.
That's true. Yeah, you know, I mean, and it's pretty, it's I don't want to say revealing or daring for its time, but it really kind of is. I mean, you know, just that a little example there of some dialogue from it is pretty biting, even by today's standards, you know, when you hear this disembodied voice saying that line.
Oh, no kidding.
You know?
Yeah, I couldn't even begin to use his voice, but the dialogue starts, "The drugs I took seemed to light up my brain. Suddenly I realized the power I had, the power to rule, to make the world grovel on my feet," and it goes on from there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I mean, stop and think about what's going on now.
Oh, yeah.
And take that back to 1897.
Exactly.
And goodness gracious, I mean, we've had crazy people running the earth back then.
Yeah, unfortunately, they're not invisible.
Yeah,
but some of them should be. But you know, I mean, this, you know, he's obviously brilliant because he's invented this serum of invisibility. But it's also done something to him, and you know, you trade something for something.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, he's losing his mind, and he's becoming a madman. You know, but and with Claude Rains' voice behind it. And the wonderful John Fulton special effects that are even still impressive today, you know, like 82 years later.
Oh, no kidding.
You know, and no computers.
No, not at all. I mean, stop and think about how you had to morph from one to another.
Yeah.
The magic of having to do that with three or four different types of projectors in order to get it onto one master film.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Good luck, kids.
I know, you know. So a lot of people, when they see some of these classics, and, you know, Metropolis is another example. If you see that German classic, mm-hmm. sci-fi film from Germany, you look and you think, well, that female robot in it looks a lot like C-3PO.
Mm-hmm.
And George Lucas made that conscious decision. So everything old is new again. You know, it's just a matter of revamping and adapting and today's technology. But he was inspired by that. And, you know, it just it's kind of neat when you see something like The Nutty Professor with Jerry Lewis.
Right.
And you see that makeup. A lot of people have not seen, unfortunately, the Frederick March version, which he won an Academy Award for, Best Actor. One of the few times a man playing a monster has won an Oscar, you know. But he patterned it after Frederick March. So now when people see, because they're familiar with The Nutty Professor,
mm-hmm.
then they see the Frederick March version, they say, it's Jerry Lewis, you know. So, it
feeds back.
It feeds backwards, yeah. Yeah. So, you know, everything is kind of inspired by something else. You know?
Right. So let's look at The Creature from the Black Lagoon that I guess gets compared a lot to Godzilla at times, and other times People just have a tendency to say, "Okay, what is that?"
Right. Well, and it owes a lot to the Beauty and the Beast theme. There's similarities between the creature and King Kong.
Well,
you know, I mean,
Quasimodo.
Yeah. I mean, it's he basically is smitten by Julie Andrews in her one-piece white bathing suit. You know, he's a gill man, but he's still, I guess, he's a man. You know, it has that Beauty and the Beast theme going for it. And although it was originally filmed in 3D, this will be shown, of course, flat. But that's not taking a thing away from it, because it wasn't one of these that threw everything at you, but a good script.
You know,
this one has a good script, and they use the 3D in the planes of water, you know.
Okay.
Very effective in a third dimension, but you see that underwater photography done quite well. I mean, it's very, very effective in a 2D version.
Horror of Dracula is one that really extols the virtues of how Peter Cushing would take a Bela Lugosi creation and push the limit beyond any expectation.
Right. You know, of course, Bela Lugosi never could really shake that cloak. You know, I mean, he was in other things, but he was forever identified as Count Dracula from 1931. And this was Great Britain's first attempt to not only do homage to Bram Stoker's original work, but to do a faithful interpretation of the novel in lurid technicolor with these two guys, Peter Cushing and Christopher Lee, that later became, you know, the Hammer House of Horrors, you know, and they were paired forevermore, generally, you know, one playing the foil to the other, and sometimes it was vice versa, you know.
Right.
Christopher Lee was sometimes a good guy, and Peter Cushing would be the villain. But this had never been done before. You know, it was in Technicolor. It was more graphic, 1958, but still, you know, that's, what, 50-some-odd years since anyone had done the Dracula, you know, based on the literature.
Mm-hmm.
There's been ripoffs and there's sequels and things like that. But this one really made the mark for Hammer Studios. The Curse of Frankenstein that appeared the year earlier, everybody sat up and took notice, and they said, okay, we're on to something, so we're going to remake Dracula. We're going to remake, Jekyll and Hyde. We're going to, you know, and then have other things going on, too, in the years that followed, like the Gorgon and things like that.
Right.
But they were masters at atmosphere, because, first of all, in England, you have a lot of those old Victorian houses still, you know, and the furnishings and everything. So everything just looked right. It looked like it was filmed in that time frame. And then you mix in Technicolor, you mix in the spirited performances of these cast members and everything, and you come up with a real doozy.
So let's the last film in the Halloween happening is The Sixth Sense. Curious choice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And it's, I think of it as a new film, even though I can't believe it's 16 years old this year.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It's unbelievable. 16 years and still fresh as yesterday.
It is. And I don't know how many people have not seen it, maybe more have heard of it than have seen it. They should see it. And like I mentioned, you know, it really bears repeated viewings, because there's clues that they're so subtle that when you see it a second, a third, or fourth time, it all clicks. There's no false routes. Everything really gels in this film, and it's a masterpiece. I'm just kind of disappointed that M. Night Shyamalan hasn't equaled that in 16 years. You know, The Signs with Mel Gibson had its moments. Lady in the Water and some of the ones since have kind of like a Twilight Zone blown up into an hour and a half, 2 hour film. But with this one, I think it everything clicks on all cylinders. Halle Jo Osment is astonishingly good as the 8-year-old boy. Bruce Willis, I don't think has ever been any better. Has a good script. It doesn't really forecast anything to where you think, oh, yeah, yeah, I knew that was all coming, you know. But at least for most of the people that I know, and certainly with me, I didn't know it. And it's breathtaking.
You know what it is? Shyamalan created a motion picture much like Boston created that first album.
Okay.
All right.
Yeah.
Everything clicked, and then afterwards you just can't get the magic back.
That's, you know, it's kind of, in a sense, it's like what happened to Orson Welles and Citizen Kane.
Right.
You know, which is considered by many to be the greatest movie ever made. How do you equal it?
Yeah, how do you top something like that? You don't.
Yeah, yeah.
Real quick here, because we're running out of time, let's talk about Halloween Afternoon over at the International Museum.
Okay.
You've got a couple of classics coming around the corner that I like. House of Wax.
How about that? We have to have Vincent Price in here, mm-hmm. You know? I mean, he's the merchant of menace.
Yeah. Yeah.
And, you know, this is the film that forever, I think, cemented his role. Because he'd been working in Hollywood as a villain or in these drawing room films and so forth for 20 years prior to House of Wax. But after that, he could never shake it. He was always wanted by Roger Corman to be in Pit and the Pendulum and House of Usher, and he was just a natural. And he's another one that's kind of a Renaissance man. You know, he was a gourmet cook and, you know, he had an art collection you wouldn't believe. And and he just happened to just have fun with these roles. And that film was a remake of a film earlier called Mystery of the Wax Museum, mm-hmm. which was in the early two Technicolor process with Lionel Atwill. And this one surpasses. I think it's an example of another... which doesn't happen often, of a remake actually surpassing the original film.
Well, you know, Vincent Price could have made bank by choosing the biggest films, the blockbusters, and all that, and instead he decided to camp literally at A&I, AI, know, American International, do the cheesy films.
Absolutely.
Because he could, because they were fun to do.
And you could be as hammy as you wanted to be, and it would kind of add to that quirky character that he was playing. But he was a good actor, and he, you know, if you've seen Laura or some of the earlier films, you know, mm-hmm. where he's just a straight dramatic performance, he was capable, but you could tell he was having fun.
Oh yeah,
you know.
Well, Jay, let's go ahead and give these folks websites where they can check stuff out, especially for today and a half hour from now over at the International Museum of Art. I hope people get out there and go.
I do too. We look forward to having everybody come out. I think they'll have a good time. Mm-hmm. And there is fresh theater popcorn.
Yay.
It's not microwaved. It's the cart type, you know, the
antique. It's the real deal.
It's the real deal. So, you know, you have that going on too. You have theater seating in an auditorium setting. And by the way, you're going to be seeing also an episode, a chapter of the original Superman serial with the Halloween presentation, you know,
very nice.
From 1948, and Kirk Allen as Superman.
Jay, let's do this again in a couple of weeks, couple of months. Well, let's get into the holidays.
Okay.
Let's plan on you coming back in a couple of weeks, and let's talk about what you got cooking for the holidays. How's that?
Sounds good. Hopefully it won't be a turkey.
Wonderful. And if it is, it better be a damn good one.
Thanks so much, Dennis. It's always a pleasure.
Jay Duncan's been our guest on El Paso Primetime.